So, hi, and welcome to the fifth and last presentation in Space 1979. Just heard the end of the Voyager recording. It ends as the sound portion of it, which is the majority of it. Remember, there are pictures as well, beginning. Began an hour and 50 minutes earlier with the cavatina from Beethoven 13 string quartet. And I don't know what extraterrestrial culture would have made of the sounds that are on this record, assuming they could use those instructions that you saw there at the end of the play. But for us, I think it's a pretty interesting thing. It's a humbling reminder of how much there is on this one planet that, you know, most of us don't know about. And I hope you had as much fun as I did with the format there, which I tried to set up deliberately so as to enable you to play guessing games and try to figure out which culture each of the pieces was from. You know, some of the space photos were quite obvious and some of them were deliberately not. And all of them I chose because I think they're pretty spectacular pictures. Some of them are, especially some of the Landsat images, are just pieces of abstract art in themselves. And it's amazing how much variety there is in the appearance of this planet from 575 miles up. That's another thing we can point out. Well, in any case, this is an item that is rather different from all the other events in that it is not something that human beings are doing. It is something that nature is putting on for us. A total eclipse of the sun is certainly one of the most magnificent spectacles that there are in nature, and if you have never seen one, you probably have no idea of what I mean by that, because the impression of it, the overwhelming awe of it, simply does not come across either from pictures, and that includes the ones I'm going to show you tonight, or, of course, watching it on television. You just have no idea what it's like to be there when you watch it on television. And I ran into a person once that I said something to this effect about, and he said, oh, I saw an eclipse, it wasn't much. And I go, why? And it turned out he'd seen a partial eclipse and figured a total eclipse, just, you know, a little bit more of the same. It is totally different. I mean, it's like the difference between a notion of water and an ocean of water. It's just a completely different kind of thing. I'm going to tell you what it looked like. I'm going to tell you where to go to see it, and that takes quite a bit of planning. And I will tell you how to see it without eye damage, which is a very serious consideration. But one thing that I cannot tell you is what it is going to feel like if you are there. And I highly recommend that if you possibly can, be free and get to the Pacific Northwest, which is where it's visible, certain parts of the Pacific Northwest is that, on February 26th of next year, that you try to do so. This is the last total solar eclipse that will be visible from anywhere in the contiguous United States in this century. There will be one other that is visible from part of the non-contiguous United States, specifically Hawaii, and also the southern part of Mexico in 1991, and that is it for this century. Unfortunately, this February 26, 1979 eclipse is not optimum in a number of respects. I mean, it's what we got. It's the only game in town, so, you know, you might as well think in terms of it anyway. But it's going to take some very careful planning if you want to see it. February in that part of the world is cloudy most of the time. I've only begun doing weather research, finding out what the best places are to look. And so I can't tell you here's a magic location. Of course, nobody can do that anyway. But I can give you some hints as to how you can find out yourself. There's going to be more and more information made available. And I try the obvious things like phoning Weather Bureau personnel in various parts of the eclipse path, and generally found that I just wasn't getting the right people because they weren't thinking the way that you have to in order to prepare for this sort of thing. I kept getting responses like, well, I can't give you a forecast a year in advance. And I couldn't get across to them. I didn't want a forecast. I knew better than that. I was trying to get statistics on how likely it was to be cloudy. Weather forecasters tend not to think in terms of cloudiness. You know, what most people want to know is it's going to rain or it's going to snow. If it doesn't rain or snow, it's your terror or overcast. But for this sort of thing, you have to worry about that. And there's also the consideration that you have to worry about it at a particular time of the day that you're interested in. It doesn't do you much good if you find a place where there's only a 30% chance of clouds. If it turns out that those 30% chance of clouds are almost always in the early morning, and the eclipse has to be in the early morning, you know, this kind of thing. Basically, what you do is, first of all, I will give you the outline of what to consider, and then you look very carefully, starting now, in the magazine Sky and Telescope, which is prepared for amateur astronomers, and which has lots of good information on all kinds of things. They always have eclipse labels, and I know that in this particular case, the person who was going to write those articles has been holding off, waiting for certain specific information, which he now should have. And so it should be coming out within the next few months, I would guess. And keep watching every issue right up to February of next year. What a total eclipse of the sun is a case where the moon traveling in its orbit around the Earth at 2,000 miles an hour, which means about its own diameter every hour, passes between a certain part of the Earth, which is where the eclipse is visible, and the sun. And it blocks out the sun, and the interest is not the fact that there is something that you can't see, but rather that there are things that you can see during total solar eclipse which are not visible any other time. For example, the very beautiful corona, the outer atmosphere of the sun, that you see in the pictures, although the pictures do not look anything like the way it looks with the naked eye, or through a telescope or through binoculars, and it's going to look very much more impressive that way. And in addition, there is something that no picture can really get across to you, and that is the magnificent, incredible, unworldly coloration all over the sky and the landscape, whose physics is something like that of the physics of the sunset coloration, but it's different because here the light is not coming from the horizon, it's coming from fairly high up in the sky. In the case of this particular eclipse, one of the other problems with it is there is no point on the eclipse path where the sun is terribly high in the sky. The maximum is 26 degrees above the horizon. In other words, if you think of the horizon of the sky as being a big dome over your head, which is the way it looks, if you draw an imaginary arc from the horizon to the zenith at 90 degrees, well, 26 degrees up of that 90 degrees is the highest the sun is going to be. And in fact, by the time you get up to the point where the sun reaches even that height, you find that you're in central Canada and the chances for good weather are even poorer than they are further east, further west on the eclipse track. So the moral of the story is, first of all, you do your best to find a location which is as likely to be cloud-free as possible, and the best statistics I've been able to dig up so far are in the desert areas of southeastern Washington and northeastern Oregon, in which the probability of overcast is all the way down to 50%. Most places it is worse than that. And so the other moral of the story is, when you get there, or preferably well before, make arrangements ahead of time, and make arrangements for everything ahead of time. You've got to realize these places are out in the backwoods, and they are not used to large influx of the tourists. And everything from motel space or camping space to food at the local grocery is going to go on a first-come, first-served basis. And if you're not first-come, you just aren't going to get it. So if I were you, I would start thinking in terms of motel reservations long about now. And of course, when you write off for them, you're going to have to explain why it is that you want them so early. As it is now, I don't think that most of the people in the affected area are yet aware that there's going to be a total solar eclipse through their particular part of the world. Certainly these weather bureau people I talked to were not, and I would guess they'd be more likely to know about it than the average motel owner. So jump now before the Chambers of Commerce is out there to discover the fact. Well, what you do is you make arrangements with the local airport and find yourself a fairly small one. If you get a big one, you're likely to find they won't let you take off during the eclipse. I discovered that in Norfolk, which is a major city in Virginia, where the eclipse was visible in 1970. Fortunately, it was clear we were able to see it from the ground, but if it hadn't been that way, all of my careful preparations about having an airplane wouldn't have mattered. At most airports, there are one or more people who have what is called an air taxi, which is a service in which they will fly you any place that you specify for a particular rate. And the rate sounds pretty reasonable until you realize that they charge the same to fly back empty, which of course makes sense from their point of view, but not particularly from yours. However, what you do in this particular case is you retain the air taxi, and you say, okay, I will pay you a certain amount of money to stand by, and if it's clear, that's fine, we'll observe it from the ground, and if it's cloudy, be ready to fly me up there. And you've got to be doing some good thinking about what you mean by cloudy. The eclipse itself can generate its own weather. The last eclipse, the first eclipse that I saw was in 1963 in Maine, was on a day that was completely clear, except for about 2 hours bracketing totality, during which there was a temperature drop of around 15 degrees, which is a typical kind of number, as a result of the sunlight being cut off. And so that generated a complete cloud cover, which totally blotted out the sky for most of the time. I was lucky, I was one of the very few people in that particular part of Maine who actually managed to see any of the corona at all. Most of them were entirely clouded out, and I was fortunate enough to be in a place where it was only partially clouded out. Totality was 53 seconds, and half of it was clouded out. It was that close. And a little hole happened to come right over the sun in the second half of totality, so it was able to see the inner part of the corona. Well, if that kind of thing happens, your pilot should be ready, standing by to take off. Another consideration is make sure that you get yourself a pilot who has an instrument flight rating. Because if he has only a visual flight rating, then if it is overcast, he is not allowed to take off and fly through the overcast, which is the very thing that you want. So, there are all these considerations. Also, make sure that you get yourself a low-wing plane and a high-wing plane for reasons that ought to be obvious, but maybe aren't if you don't know about planes. There are planes with the wings under the windows, and those are the ones that you want for this. And there are planes with the wings over the windows, and since the wings are not ordinarily transparent, those are not what you want for them, you see? So there are all kinds of considerations. Above all, there's the consideration of where the eclipse is going to be visible as total, and it's going to be visible as partial over the entire United States. I forget if that's true or Alaska, but certainly the whole contiguous U.S. But you don't care about that. What you're interested in is the total phase. That is visible only along a narrow strip. This one is wider than most, in fact, but it's still less than 200 miles wide, which stretches for a length of several thousand miles from a point out in the Pacific Ocean onshore just about at the center line, is just about at the boundary between Washington and Oregon. And it continues just about along that boundary and then swings up through the panhandle of Idaho through central Montana. In fact, most of the state of Montana managed to be in the eclipse track. And then leaves the United States, the central line leaves the United States just about at the point where Canada, Montana, and North Dakota meet. And then it swings on up through Winnipeg, almost dead center of Winnipeg, and crosses Lake Winnipeg. But by then, of course, your chances for clear weather are very low. So, if you've got friends in Winnipeg, forget it. Visit them some other time. And then on up into Hudson's Bay and finally back on land, and I assume you're not interested in those particularly either. But as for the other areas, I have detailed maps starting with a small scale map that shows the entire eclipse track and the entire region of the Earth where the partial eclipse is visible, then going on to a medium scale map, which is a copy of Erwin Reich's physiographic map of the United States, so you can see at a glance where the mountains and where the plateaus and so forth are. And on that, the north edge labeled N all the way along it, and the south edge labeled F all the way along it are indicated. And then finally, maps of all the states and of Manitoba and Saskatchewan, all the states where it's visible and those two provinces, which are labeled with N for the north, C for the central line, and S for the south edge of this strip. And if you want to go and see it, what I suggest you do, you're interested in the central line. The central line is the best place to be. And if you can't be on the central line, be within 50 miles north or south of the central line. In other words, be within the central half of this roughly 200 mile wide eclipse track. The reason for that is that at any given location, at any given cross section across the track, the length of totality, which at most is only a little over 2 minutes, so it's going to be, you're going all that distance for 2 minutes, you don't want to lose any seconds by being in the wrong place. The length is greatest at the central line and falls off to zero as you go out in either direction from the central line. So you don't want to be at the north edge, you don't want to be at the south edge, but if you're halfway from the center line to the north edge or the south edge, the duration of totality is only 87% 87% of what it would be on the central line. So that's why I say you want to be somewhere in the central half, in other words, on the central line or within 50 miles of it. And what I suggest you do, if you're interested in going, is simply come up here after the talk and try to give you enough time to do that, and copy down a list of enough towns which the central line happens to pass through that you can then go home and regenerate these maps in your own road maps. The particular road maps that I used are from the Rand McNally Road Atlas, which is only $40 in the local bookstores, so it won't set you back an arm and a leg if you buy it. Of course, if you have road maps of your own in those states, or a member of AAA or whatever, that's fine too. And finally, you have to consider where along the central line you want to be, and I will try to give you some hints about that a little bit later on. Let me first tell you some more detail about what goes on in both the eclipse of the sun and the eclipse of the moon. There is also going to be, we have the lights out here, there's also going to be a total eclipse of the moon next year, which will be visible from right here in Detroit. And that is not the last one of the century or anything of the sort. However, it is an especially interesting one because the moon is going to set while it is still totally eclipsed. And what that means is that if you are a photographer and if you know ahead of time exactly where it's going to set, and I will tell you, once I tell you right this minute, it's going to set at the point of the horizon that is 9.5 degrees south of due west. And if you know that, then you can scout around until you find an especially pleasing foreground in that particular direction and be ready to get some utterly spectacular pictures. That is something you will have a chance to do from Detroit only once in the remainder of this century, and that will be on December 30th of 1982. And since December 30th, the chances for clear weather are very much poorer than they would be on September 5th of next year, which is the day for that. So I'll tell you about that as well. A total eclipse of the moon occurs when the moon, passing its orbit around the Earth, passes on the opposite side from the sun, in other words, passes through the shadow of the Earth. And so in the one case, they're not really the same kind of event. In the one case, in the case of the eclipse of the sun, it's a matter of the moon physically getting between you and the sun and blocking off the sun. In the other case, what's blocking off your view of the moon is simply the fact that the sunlight, which normally makes it visible, is not shining on it. The moon is still there, nothing is between you and it, but it's passed in the shadow of the Earth. And in fact, it does not become totally invisible for reasons that I will show you, and that is indeed the beauty of a total lunar eclipse. This thing is an early morning event. The full moon, and it must be full to be totally eclipsed, set at sunrise. And so we're talking about something where you want to do a little bit of rearrangement of your sleep schedule. But if you are a photographer, and especially someone with a telephoto lens, you have a chance to get them almost literally once in a lifetime picture. You know, I wouldn't worry about that December 30th event. Chances are it's a once in a lifetime event. Let me show you briefly the structure of the shadow of either the Earth or the Moon. Here's the Earth, and if the Sun were a simple point of light, then the shadow of the Earth would be equally simple. It would simply be a cone like this. And every place that was inside this cone would be invisible. If something such as the moon went through that cone, it would disappear when it entered it, remain invisible until it got to the other side, and abruptly become visible as it passed out. However, the sun is not a simple point of light. It has a certain amount of size to it. So you have to consider this a little bit more complicated. Let's say it's safe. Pretend that the sun was two points of light, separated from one another. Well, then one of them would cast a shadow, which would be this region. The other one would cast a shadow, which would look like this. An object that was in this portion, region one, called these A and B, would be able to see A, but not B. And so it would be illuminated, it would be only half as bright as it would be if it were outside the shadow region altogether. An object in region two would be able to see neither A nor B, and so it would be totally dark. And an object in region 3 would be able to see B but not A, and so again, it would be darker than it would be ordinarily, but it would not be completely dark. Okay, now let us go to the real situation in which the sun is a continuous source, like so, but again, we'll consider A and B as being the two edges. What happens now is that as an object goes through region 1, as it hits the edge of region 1, it is not able to see B, but it is able to see the whole rest of the sun. So it is theoretically a minuscule amount less bright than it would be otherwise, but the difference is so small you're not going to notice it. However, as it goes farther and farther and farther into region 1, more and more and more of the sun is cut off, and therefore it gets darker and darker until finally it gets to the edge of region 1, the boundary between region 1 and 2, where it can see only the one edge of the sun, only one point, and that is point A. And so it's almost as dark there as it would be if there were no light on whatsoever. Then as it goes through region 2, it can see none of the sun, and so it's completely dark. And then as it comes out again through region 3, and it can see only a very tiny part of the sun, so it's still almost completely dark. And as it moves through, it becomes brighter and brighter and brighter until finally we're getting full brightness at the edge of region 3. Okay? Now remember that this is simply a cross-section. You have got to consider that it is actually three-dimensional. And so, in fact, region 1 and region 2 are part of a continuous ring of partial shadow. And region 1 and region 3, part of a continuous ring of partial shadow. And region 2 is a central cone of total shadow. And you've got the structure of a point of shadow. Let's redraw this now. Here is the Earth. And here is the cone from which, you understand why it's a cone, this is going towards one edge of the sun, this is going towards the other edge of the sun, from which the all the light is excluded, or it would be if it weren't for something I haven't told you yet. That is called the umbra, which is simply the Latin word for shadow. An umbrella is literally a little shadow. See, it was a parasol before it was something to keep the rain off, and so it's the same word. And then the outer portion, which is that continuous as the cone too, but it diverges out from the sun because this edge is heading towards one edge of the sun and this edge is heading towards the other, that region is called the penumbra. Pen-A is a Latin, M-B-R-A. Pen-A is a Latin prefix meaning almost, and it is not terribly often used in English. There's the geologic term peneplain, which means almost the plain, and there is the penultimate, whatever is the next to last in a series of something, okay? And this is the penumbra. There is a fourth region of the shadow, and that is back here. An object that is in here is seeing the edges of the sun, but it is not able to see the center of the sun, because the Earth is blocking off the center of the sun. And so what it sees is the sun as a ring around a big black blob that is in the middle of it. That is called an annular eclipse of the sun. Don't confuse that word with annual, which means yearly. This is annular, A-N-N-U-L-A-R. It comes from the Latin word annulus, meaning ring. And those of you who are into zoology know that the earthworms and the leeches and those good things are in the phylum Annelida, which comes from the ring-shaped segments that their bodies are made of, and it's the same sort of group. So if you are in the umbra of the Earth, I'm talking about a lunar eclipse here, again, consider that the moon is not a point. So part of it could be in the umbra, part of it would be in the penumbra. Let's consider that it were a point to begin with. If it's in the penumbra, then it is undergoing a partial eclipse. If it's in the umbra, it's undergoing a total eclipse. If it's in the penumbra, it's undergoing a partial eclipse again. If it's back here in this section, it is simply partially lighted up. As far as you can tell, it looks like as though it's partially eclipsed. But an observer on the moon is seeing something that is different here than he would be seeing here. That is, he would be seeing an annular eclipse of the sun. All right, now consider the fact that the moon is not a point. So, when it is anywhere, when either part of it or all of it is in the penumbra, it is said to be penumbrally eclipsed. When part of it is in the umbra, but not all, and the rest is all in the penumbra, is the moon is said to be partially eclipsed. When all of the moon is within the umbra, it's said to be totally eclipsed, or umbrally eclipsed, but usually totally. And then when it gets out again, so that part of it is in the penumbra and part of it is in the umbra, then that is the concluding partial phase. In other words, it goes on either side of the total phase, there is a partial phase, and there's a penumbral phase on either side of that. The penumbral phase is the most unexciting part, and actually the most exciting part or if you don't want to see the entire thing, is probably the last 10 minutes or so of the partial eclipse and the beginning of totality. The reason that this is interesting, and the reason the moon is so beautiful when it's in the umbra, is that the umbra, contrary to everything that I told you so far, is not a total shadow, and the reason for that is that the Earth has an atmosphere. So, as the light of the sun passes through that atmosphere, some of it gets bent around. The atmosphere acts like a lens, and gets into the umbra and illuminates, faintly, something that might be in the umbra. As the light goes through the atmosphere of the Earth, let's do a more detailed diagram of this little section here. As the light goes through the atmosphere of the Earth, not all would get through. The atmosphere is by no means completely transparent. And since it's going horizontally, it's passing through a large amount of air, much more than if we're going through vertically. So light is scattered out in all directions as it goes through by the molecules of the air, and it is scattered out in such a way that more of the longer wavelength makes it through than the shorter. The nature of the physical mechanism that causes the scattering is such that the shorter the wavelength, the more likely the light is to get scattered. In fact, it's a very strong wavelength dependence. Blue is 16 times as likely as red to get scattered. And so people who are down here, for example, say, okay, the sun's over there, but I am seeing light when I look up there, and that is nothing more interweb than the reason the sky is blue. The reason that you see light from everywhere in the sky, not just from the sun, and the reason it is blue. The reason it's blue being that the blue is scattered much more efficiently than the red. Blue being short wavelength, red being long wavelength. So what makes it through? Well, what makes it through all the way is the very longest wavelength, and that is red. And so red light is bent around into the umbra, and when the moon is in the umbra, you have this eerie, beautiful, coppery-colored glow on it, which in fact varies its color from eclipse to eclipse, because it depends on the amount of dust, the amount of cloudiness, the amount of pollution, the amount of all kinds of things that happen to be in the ring of sunlight, that in the ring of the Earth's atmosphere, which is having sunset or sunrise at the particular moment that the eclipse is going on. In other words, the portion near the edge of the lightest part of the Earth. All right, all of that is how you understand a lunar eclipse. To get back to a solar eclipse, you've got to consider that the moon's shadow has all that same structure, minus a bit with the atmosphere. The moon has no air, so its umbra is totally dark. There is a further complication, which is that the length of the moon's umbra is almost exactly equal to the distance between the moon and the Earth. The distance between the moon and the Earth doesn't always remain the same. The moon's orbit is not perfectly circular. Furthermore, the length of the umbra depends on the distance of the sun. Think about what determines that angle, and we'll see why. And the distance of the sun varies during the course of the year. So sometimes, when the moon's shadow hits the Earth, the point, the tip of the shadow, doesn't quite make it all the way to the Earth. And then we see an annular eclipse on the Earth. You probably, most of you, I'd be willing to bet, never heard of annular eclipses until just now, but in fact, they are actually slightly commoner than total eclipses. If the moon is unusually close to the Earth, and or the Earth is unusually close to the sun, and in February we have both those conditions, believe it or not, the day of the year when the Earth is closest to the sun is at the beginning of January, and the day of the year when it's farthest from the sun is at the beginning of July, and that proves very dramatically that the seasons of the Earth are not caused by variations in the Earth's distances from the sun. If those conditions are met, then the umbra will come down, and it will be able to hit the Earth, and the pin umbra, of course, is hitting the Earth as well, and so what happens? Well, somebody who is here in this portion where the penumbra, where the umbra is hitting the Earth, is seeing the sun totally blocked off. That is referred to as a total eclipse of the sun. A person who is anywhere in this penumbra region is seeing part of the sun blocked off, but not all, and that is referred to as a partial eclipse of the sun. Notice we use the same words here as we did for a lunar eclipse. They have different meanings. It's a different kind of phenomenon. And there is nothing corresponding in the eclipse of the sun. There is nothing corresponding to the penumbra eclipse of the moon, so-called. Well, as the moon moves in its orbit around the Earth, and as the Earth rotates, the tip of the umbra traces a path across the Earth. The moon's shadow moves across the Earth at a speed of several thousand miles an hour. It depends on the eclipse. question, it depends on where you are and given the question. The penumbra also traces a shadow across the earth, traces a path across the earth, and so there is a region within a very narrow linear region, narrow because the tip of the shadow is just barely within the earth, and so the cross-section there is very small, narrow region from which you can see the total eclipse, not all the time, of course, but at one time or another, if you are in that narrow strip, the umbra is going to pass by you, and you are going to see the eclipse, so you're going to see the sun more. An eclipse, because the umbra passes by you, if you are in the shadow path, if you're in the eclipse track, that is the track of the umbra itself, the total eclipse is going to be both preceded and followed by a partial eclipse. You start out with a little light out of the edge of the sun, the moon covers more and more and more and more of the sun until finally the entire sun is covered. That lasts for only a very short period of time because of the remarkable coincidence that the length of the shadow is almost exactly equal to the distance from the moon to the earth. And so another way to put that is that the size of the moon as seen in the sky is almost exactly equal to the size of the sun as seen in the sky. Now, you understand, I'm talking about a pattern of size. Of course, the sun is much bigger than the moon. In fact, it's 400 times bigger. But it's also 400 times farther away. And so those two numbers exactly cancel. And by one of the most remarkable coincidences in astronomy, the two sizes are so nearly equal that you can have a total eclipse and yet it lasts only a couple of minutes out of the one-month period that it takes for the moon to go around the Earth. There is no other planet on which there is such a coincidence. Every other planet, you would see either an eclipse in which the moon would block off the sun and a good deal of sky around the sun, or an annular eclipse. In the case of Mars, for example, you would see only an annular eclipse from either of its moons. In the case of Jupiter, you would get, in some cases, a total eclipse, but you'd never be able to see the whole ring of corona at once, because so much of the sun would get blocked out, or else for some of the more distant moons, you'd see annular eclipses. Only the Earth has this opportunity, and since over the course of geologic time, the moon is slowly moving away from the Earth, we will not have that opportunity forever. You come back a billion years from now, and you're not going to be total eclipses in the sun. So get yours while the getting is good. It's the only planet where you can do it, and only now, only this time in the geologic history can you. Okay, at this point, I would like the first slide, if I may. And I will show you, okay, let's run forward, and I will show you okay, as I said, I'd like the first slide, which is this one. This is a picture of, hello, is this thing working? This is a picture of what you normally think of as the sun. This is the bright part. Of course, you realize that if you take a photograph of the sun through a telescope, as this one was done at Mount Wilson Observatory, you've got to take it through a very dark black piece of glass, or you're going to burn a hole right through your film, and I will say more about filters in a moment. So this is not nearly as bright as the real sun is. However, other than that, it's a good idea of what the surface of the sun looks like. I don't know if you all know what the sun is. You know that it's a star, but I don't know if everybody knows what a star is. For example, the sun is not made of fire. As a matter of fact, you could not start a fire on the sun. It is too hot to burn. If you tried to start a fire on the sun, it would go out. The reason the sun is so bright, and the reason the other stars shine as well, is not that they're on fire, but simply that they are very, very hot. And like anything else that is very hot, they glow. And it's as simple as that. They are not burning. They're simply shining for the same reason as the element on an electric hot plate glows, for example. It is not burning, it's not on fire, it's simply very hot, and so it shines for that reason. The surface of the sun has a temperature of 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is so hot that no known material could remain solid or even liquid at that temperature. And so there is, for example, iron in the sun. In fact, there are all the materials that make up the rocks and minerals, the metals on the Earth, but they're all gases at that temperature. There couldn't possibly be anything else. Note, please, that a star does not have 5 points coming out of it or any other number. It is perfectly round, and the reason is that its own gravity, which of course is pulling equally in all directions, is pulling it into a symmetrical shape, and that symmetrical shape is a sphere. And finally, given the fact that it's at such a high temperature, it's got to be made entirely of gases. In fact, the sun is mostly hydrogen and helium.
99% of that is hydrogen and helium, and those would be gases even at Earth temperatures, but as I mentioned, all the other substances that make up the Earth are in there as well. So what a star is a very large, oh, I didn't mention that, this sunspot right there is about the size of the Earth. As I say, it's very large. If the sun were hollow, you could drop in over 1 million Earths and still have room left over. Put another way, if you put the Earth in the center there, the moon would be about there. The entire orbit of the moon could easily fit inside the sun. So it is a very large object. It is a very large, very hot ball of glowing gas. Five items to that description, and that's what a star is. Now, the reason that you are able to see it, despite the fact that it's a gas, is that it's a very unusual gas. It is opaque. By that, I do not mean the way the word is generally used in everyday life, which means something black. What I mean is that it is something you can't see through. It's glowing, but you still can't see through it. If you try to look through the element of an electric hot plate, you're not going to be able to see through it, even though it is not black. It's opaque in that sense. Why the sun is opaque is a very interesting story, but it's also a very long one. Suffice it to say that it's due to the fact that conditions on the sun in that kind of temperature are very different from conditions in the gases that you're used to on Earth, which of course are not opaque. But above this layer, which is called the photosphere, which simply means ball of light, that is opaque and that is therefore brightly shining, is the uppermost layer of the opaque gas that is what you see as the outer edge of the sun, as a so-called surface, which of course is not a surface at all. Nothing solid there. It's not even particularly heavy gas. It averages about one-tenth as dense as the air in this room. So even if, you know, you couldn't land on a star, even if you could somehow stand the temperature, there's nothing to land on. It's just a big ball of rather tenuous gas. It gets less tenuous further down inside, but you'd have to go almost halfway from the surface to the center before you got to gas that was even as dense as the air in this room. At the center, it's 20 times as dense, it's 10 times as dense as light, but that's because of the weight of the overlying material. But most of it is fairly well spread out. And there is, in fact, gas above this photosphere as well. It's just that you can't see it because it is transparent. It is almost perfectly transparent. We can refer to that as the atmosphere of the sun. I'm using the term there a little bit differently from the way astronomers generally do. They include the photosphere in the term atmosphere as well. But I'm going to call the photosphere this, and the transparent layers above it the atmosphere, and that's the terminology that wasn't used until around 1910, so just assume I'm a little bit behind the times. The atmosphere of the sun is almost 100% transparent, but it does glow very, very faintly. And so the nice thing about an eclipse from an astronomer's point of view, and the reason that professional astronomers spend literally millions of dollars to observe those few minutes of totality, is that the moon will cover over the photosphere perfectly for you, for reasons that I just explained, and then and only then can you see the atmosphere of the sun by the very faint but not completely zero light that it puts out. Well, you don't see that until the eclipse is total. So we started out with a partial eclipse. Here is an early stage in a partial eclipse of the sun. You can see a sunspot there. The sunspots, by the way, are simply areas in the sun that they're not completely black. If you look at these pictures, they are simply areas of the sun which are less hot than the rest and therefore less bright than the rest. And in these pictures, which make everything look much darker than it is anyway, they appear black. Actually, the sunspots themselves are so bright that if I could wave a magic wand and make the whole sun disappear except for that sunspot, the sunspot itself would be bright enough to blind you if you looked at it. But it's not as bright as the rest of the sun. It's only 8,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The rest of the sun is 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Again, what makes it hot is a long story. Briefly, it's because of the strong magnetic field there, and that can cool a gas under these conditions. Well, the important thing to understand about a partial eclipse of the sun is that you should not look at it unless you have adequate eye precaution. And definitely you should not photograph it unless you have adequate precaution. Most people have heard by this time that it is not safe to look at a partial eclipse of the sun. In fact, there's been so much publicity about it that now you run into the very sad phenomenon, I think, of people who live right in the eclipse track. They have a once-in-a-lifetime chance. In fact, more than that, on the average, a total eclipse of the sun is visible from a given location only once every 350 years. And they could see this magnificent spectacle by simply going out to their backyards, but they have been so terrified that they pull the blinds and they stay inside and they watch it on television. And you can't tell them that the total phase is safe to look at. They've read in the newspapers. They know better. So, you know, don't try to argue with them, but in fact the total phase is perfectly safe. The atmosphere of the sun is so faint, well, it's over a million times fainter than the photosphere, and that is not bright enough to do any damage. But the photosphere is. Now, as I say, most people have heard by this time that for some reason it's not safe to look at a partial eclipse of the sun, but most of them don't know the reason for it, and so a lot of people don't really believe it. At the last total eclipse of the sun, which was visible in the United States, and which of course was preceded and followed by a dangerous partial phase, 300 people were blinded. Most of them admitted afterwards, when asked, that they had heard the warnings and had not believed them. So I want you to know it is really true that it's dangerous. What happens is obvious to anybody who has ever held up a magnifying glass to the sun and burned a hole in a piece of paper with it. The lens focuses the rays of the sun onto a very tiny spot at the piece of paper, which therefore becomes intensely hot and bursts into flame. The danger here is that the lens of your eye, or actually I mean the lens, the cornea, and the aqueous humor, which all act as a single lens together, will do the same thing. They will focus the sun onto the back of your retina and burn a hole in the retina. That sounds as though it would be a gruesome experience. It is not. The really horrible thing about it is that there is no feeling of pain whatsoever to warn you that it's happening, because there are no pain nerves in the retina. And so you blind yourself for life and you don't even know that it's happened until you look away and discover you can't see anything. You can in fact see things. It's an especially horrible kind of blindness, because where the hole gets burned is in the fovea centralis, the point on the retina which focuses whatever you are looking directly at. And so you can see everything except what you're trying to look at. You have a hole in the center of your field of vision which you cannot get rid of, and anything that you try to look at is immediately covered over by this hole. So believe me, you do not want it to happen to you. The reason that it is more dangerous to look at a partial eclipse than to look at the sun in general, and after all, let's face it, most of us have looked at the sun one time or another and gotten away with it. It's never really safe. But it is more dangerous during the partial eclipse because the eye does have built-in safety mechanisms which will usually protect you if you try to stare at the sun. In fact, they are so good that even if you think you're staring at the sun, you probably aren't. The eye either involuntarily moves away briefly, but enough to rest that part of the retina before it becomes hot, or else tears develop, or there are in fact a whole bunch of them. And you may think you're staring at the sun, but in fact you are not. It is never really safe to do this, because those mechanisms are not 100% perfect, but generally they work, and generally you can get away with it. However, during the partial eclipse, especially during the latter phases of it, the brightness of the sun is reduced enough that it turns off the safety mechanism, but not enough that it won't do any damage. And in fact, only 1% of the photosphere is enough to burn a hole into your retina. So it is more dangerous to look during a partial eclipse. Furthermore, most of the common filters, which people mistakenly use in the belief that they are safe, are not. That goes definitely for smoked glass. It is not safe to look at the sun through smoked glass. Usually, the smoked glass is simply not dense enough to cut down the light enough, but it may be dense enough to cut down the light enough to turn off your eye's safety mechanisms. A thin layer of cloud, which may be so thin that you don't even see it in all that glare of the sun, can do the same thing even when there's no eclipse. And that's why I say it's never really safe to look at the sun at any time. But it is usually you can get away with it. Usually there doesn't happen to be a layer of cloud there, just the right density. Welder's goggles are not safe. They do generally cut down the visible light enough, but they do not cut down the infrared. Infrared is invisible, the eye cannot see it, but the lens still focuses it, and even though you can't see it, it is enough to burn the hole in the retina by itself. Cross Polaroids are not safe. They transmit ultraviolet, and again, you can't see that, but it can be focused. And so on and so forth. Sunglasses, of course, are not enough. And there are such things as safe sun filters, but they are relatively expensive and they are relatively hard to get a hold of. Kodak says that two thicknesses of totally overexposed black and white, not color, photographic film are safe. In other words, you go down to the camera store, you buy yourself a roll of outdated black and white film, and this is the only reason you should ever buy outdated film, for anything else it's no good. You simply take it out, you buy it off the shelf, you take it out, you expose it to the light, you unroll it. You know, you can have lots of fun with the camera store person. You unroll it, take a good look at it, and say, "This looks pretty good." And then you hand it to the guy and say, "Okay, send this in to be processed." And by that time, he'll be very, very anxious to serve you and get you out of the store, you know. And so they'll do it for you. And then what you'll get is totally black negatives. Kodak says that if you use two of those negatives, it is safe to look at the sun through them. I am not going to tell you that, because I am not going to take the responsibility for you that you are absolutely certain that you know how to do this right, you know, that you really do expose it properly and uniformly and completely. And furthermore, there's always the dangerous possibility that the processing lab that particular day might happen to run your particular film through semi-exhausted chemicals, and it may not come out totally developed and that kind of thing. I have some pieces of overexposed film which I have used safely to look at the sun with, but I am not going to tell you that it's safe for you, because it is possible that you could do something wrong, and for one thing, I don't want to be legally responsible if it does go wrong that way. But I pass this on to you for whatever it may be worth. The problem, of course, is that you can't be certain that it's that a given piece is safe until you try it, you know, and it's a rather difficult thing to do. If you want to do it, I would suggest using it only for very brief glimpses, and use your non-dominant eye. So, you know, at least that minimizes the loss. It would still be a pretty great loss, but at least it wouldn't be as great as if you use your dominant eye and you really stare at it. There are safe sun filters, and this picture was taken through one. This is a commercial slide, but I have taken pictures of my own. That advertises every month in all the photography magazines. Used to sell those filters, and I don't know if they still are. If you want to take pictures, the Spirotone filters were very useful because they were in the standard filter sizes. You could screw them directly onto your camera lens. But, and of course, again, they were safe to look through. Normal gelatin photographic filters are not safe to look through. They transmit infrared. And what this means is, if you are taking pictures of this sort, you must not even look through the finder of your camera. In fact, be very careful if you aim any optical instrument at the sun. Be sure that you have blocked off not only that you've got a safe sun filter in front of the telescope, not at the eyepiece or the binoculars. Make sure you've got a safe sun filter in front of the thing so that the light is blocked out before it gets into the instrument. Those sun filters that are sold for use at the eyepiece are not safe. The heat can be very intense. A friend of mine who had a 10-inch telescope, which is fairly good size for an amateur telescope, nothing for a professional telescope, used to like to demonstrate how he could aim it at the sun and melt aluminum held at the eyepiece in a few seconds. So you do not want to put your eye in proximity to that kind of heat, protected only by a little glass filter which could crack as a result of the heat with no warning. I have had it happen to me once in my life, and I am never going to use a filter like that again. I was very lucky. I had trained myself to push the telescope away if I heard a crack. And that is the reason that I'm still looking at you now. You know, it's just not a safe thing to do. And this was a very tiny telescope, a little 3-inch telescope. So you want a filter which will go in front of the telescope, and be sure that you block off the finder, that you block off any auxiliary instruments that might be pointing in the same direction. Even if nobody looks through it, you can very easily crack your optics by pointing things at the sun. The sun is a hydrogen bomb going off. And you don't mess around with hydrogen bombs. They are dangerous. They are highly energetic. The fact that it's 93 million miles away is no consolation. It's got more hydrogen than most hydrogen bombs do. It's converting 4.5 million tons of hydrogen into pure energy every second. So, okay, I've gone on at this at some length because it's important to do it. You know, people think either, oh, it's not really a danger, I've looked at the sun and gotten away with it, or else they think, well, it doesn't matter, I've got a safe filter, and the chances are they don't. There is one company called Solar Screen, or the name of the guy is Roger Tuthill, and I guess the company is Roger Tuthill Incorporated. The trade name of the stuff is Solar Screen, and he says that it is safe. It is aluminum evaporated onto a thin plastic film, and he'll sell it to you in small sizes to look at through the eye, in larger sizes to put over a camera lens, a telephoto lens, or in still larger sizes to put over a telescope. And again, I'm not going to warrant the stuff because it's always possible you might get a defective piece or something, but if you want to check it out, he advertises this kind of telescope every month.
Well, to continue, the partial phase is what you start out with. This is a 24% partial phase, in other words, 24% of the diameter of the sun is hidden. And this is the one time when it's actually prettier if you have clouds. Here is a picture which I took of a partial phase through a spirochrome filter at the 1972 eclipse, partially cloudy. And you can see it's a prettier picture than it would be otherwise, but of course when totality came along, I didn't appreciate it.
The problem with the corona is that it's so very, very faint that even if you have thin cirrus clouds, which you can see the photosphere through with no trouble at all, so you look up and you say, oh, they're thin clouds, they won't bother me, comes the corona a million times fainter and you can't see it at all.
The partial phase continues. Here is what the maximum is of the eclipse that you are going to see in Detroit will be, except that it'll be almost, this is a 72% partial, you will see an 80% partial, except that this point here, the middle of the part that's hidden, will be just about up at the top of the disk. And the reason that you see a partial eclipse when people in Washington State, for example, are seeing a total eclipse,
is that you are in a slightly different place on the Earth, and so you are seeing the Moon in a slightly different direction. The Sun is not directly behind the Moon as seen from here. It is directly behind the Moon as seen from the places on the eclipse track.
Here is a rare photograph showing the very, very end of the partial phase, and even this much would be enough to blind you if you looked at it.
So don't look at it. Look at the ground. You will be able to tell when totality begins. Don't worry.
Even though the sun has gotten very dark up to this point, there is a noticeable increase in darkening when totality begins. Furthermore, there's a fascinating phenomenon called shadow bands. Nobody really knows what it is that causes them. But if you set out a sheet on the ground, and be sure to take a sheet with you if you go to see the eclipse for just this reason, if you set out a sheet on the ground, you see these hundreds and hundreds of little ripply bands which seem to move across the sheet, all moving in one direction, parallel to the direction of travel of the moon's shadow, and they are easy to see, but almost impossible to photograph. They involve contrast between the dark parts and the bright parts of only about 1%. The eye happens to be especially good at detecting faint contrast. Photographic film is not nearly as good, and so there are very few photographs that have been taken of shadow bands to show them at all, and those were taken with special techniques, high contrast film, that kind of thing. The shadow bands become most intense in the last 5 minutes. This is the point where things are really getting awe-inspiring. The eye's brightness control, the automatic adjustments for change in brightness, the widening of the pupils and that sort of thing, is effective enough that until about the last 5 minutes before totality, you really don't notice any tremendous change in brightness in the landscape. And then all of a sudden, it begins to get darker, and then darker, and darker, and darker, and darker, and darker, and it goes on and on and on getting darker, as though somebody were turning down the lights in the theater, but just going on, and of course it's outdoors. And at the same time, you have these magnificent colors beginning to develop around the sky and around the landscape, and you have a hush which settles over the landscape, which is a real effect. It probably would not be as strong in February as it has been for the last few eclipses, which all happen to be in the summer, the last few visible from this part of the world, but it is due to the cessation of activity of animals, birds and insects particularly, because they think that night is coming on. And there are a lot of studies that have been done by behavioral scientists of what happens when you suddenly have darkness in the middle of the day. Is the animal going to believe it, think that night is coming on, and act as that particular beast normally would, you know, roost or whatever, or is it just going to ignore it? And of course, the interest is that if the animal has a built-in clock, circadian rhythms, then it will ignore it. And briefly, the result of these studies have been, for some species, they ignore it, for others, they act as though night were coming on, and for still others, they just run around in circles and get very confused. In case of people, well, it used to be they ran around in circles and got very confused, but now we know what it is that's happening. So you get this hush, you get this unbelievable darkening of the landscape, and in the last 5 minutes, the darkening becomes very obvious, and it's obvious that something is going wrong with the light. Then you look down at the ground for your shadow bands. In a February eclipse, the chances are excellent that there will be snow from horizon to horizon.
And the shadow bands on that snow must be just mind-blowing. That is going to be, I think, the most memorable specific feature of this particular eclipse for a person who has seen several. Generally, you take a sheet along, and so you have a few square feet of white in front of you. Seeing it over the entire lower hemisphere of your field of vision must be a really fantastic thing to see. And then, at the very end, as the last bit of photosphere disappears, you see the innermost layer of the sun's atmosphere, and that is the chromosphere. This particular eclipse was a very unusual one. It had essentially zero duration of totality. The moon's disk was so nearly equal in size to the sun's disk that you could actually see the chromosphere around almost the entire edge of the moon. And you can also see prominences, which are large streams of, they're not flames. Sometimes they look like flames and sometimes they don't. People have a tendency when they see pictures of them to assume that they're flames because, of course, they think the sun is made of fire, but they're not. They can stick very much further out than that. There are prominences that have extended out like this. In other words, greater than the distance from the Earth to the Moon. And there are a lot of things about prominences we don't understand, like exactly what it is that maintains them, what keeps them up in the air that high, and so forth. The chromosphere is a thin layer. It's only about 20,000 miles thick. In other words, only about three times the diameter of the Earth. And it is the lowest part and the brightest part of the sun's atmosphere. It's hotter than the photosphere underneath, believe it or not. And if you find that hard to believe, to understand, so do astronomers. It's one of the major problems in solar physics. It is named chromosphere, which means sphere of color, because it is red, and that red light, that intense red light, is the glow that is emitted by hydrogen, which is the most abundant atom in the sun. And in this eclipse, as with most eclipses, you will not see the entire chromosphere at once. You'll see it at one edge of the moon, at one edge of the sun as the moon goes over, and then at the end of totality, you will see it uncovered at the other edge. And then finally, you see the most magnificent spectacle of all, and that is the corona. Now, a picture like this does not even hint at the magnificence, the beauty of the corona as seen by the eye. And the reason is that from the innermost part of the corona, which is the only part that this particular photograph is exposed correctly to show, to the outermost part, which the eye can easily see glowing, because the eye has this fantastic ability to change its sensitivity from point to point on the retina. From there to there is a range in brightness of the order of 1 to 1 million. So that the figure that I gave you for the brightness of the corona earlier was an average. The eye can take all of that in. Photographic film cannot. And so all you get in a picture like this is bit by piece. If we give you a slightly longer exposure, then already the part that you just saw is overexposed, and then there is a narrow zone to correctly expose, and then again everything else outside that is underexposed. And you don't see the structure. You have only a hint that there is some sort of lineation here in the corona. And as you go farther out, if your mind were capable of adding together all the different zones, then indeed you would get from the picture an idea of what it looks like with the naked eye at a casual glance, but of course you don't. And as you go still further out, you get more and more corona on the photograph until finally you can get a picture like this. And this is about the edge of what the eye is able to see, and you can see that this is so badly overexposed in almost all of it that in fact the overexposure is beginning to encroach onto the edge of the moon itself. Here is a picture which comes closest of all the photographs that I've ever seen of capturing the way the corona looks with the eye, but it's garish. I mean, it's ugly in that respect. The real corona has an understated, soft, pastel tone to it. It looks like a painting by an old master. In fact, it reminded me when I first saw it in 1970 I saw it through clouds in 63, but that doesn't count. Of some sort of engraving in old ivory. It is a magnificent, quiet kind of scene. And this picture doesn't give you that idea at all. But it does at least indicate, the way they took this picture was, it was taken through a special filter, which is a million times denser in here than it is out here. And so it went through different amounts of light in different zones, and you get some notion. There are mismatches where the brightness of the corona didn't match what they thought it was going to be when they made the filter. But you get some notion of the structure of the corona that you see with the eye. The corona comes in rays which are grouped into bundles of this sort.
They differ in appearance. This is near solar maximum, and we're getting on towards that again, actually. So you'll see that something like the same sort of structure as the 79 eclipse. You have polar rays at the north pole of the sun and at the south pole of the sun, and then you have these bundles near the equator. And if all this reminds you of iron filings and a magnetic field, that is exactly what you're seeing. These are magnetic fields above active regions on the sun. There are sunspots down there. This is the general magnetic field of the sun. The north magnetic pole is near the north pole of the sun, and the south magnetic pole is near the south pole of the sun, or else the other way around. The north magnetic pole is near the south pole of the sun, and vice versa. It flips every 11 years or so with every new solar activity cycle.
Okay.